From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Next hour, the intuitive predictions of Sean David Morton. I'm looking forward to that. By the way, thanks for your many emails sending me that energy, trying to shake me of this wretched cold that I've had since Monday. I think it's working. Anyway, I'll be with you all night tonight. And tomorrow, I'm taking one vacation day. Ian Punnett will fill in for me. Kind of funny, bad boy from the NighthawkZone.com last night while they were chatting, listening to the program, said, I think George is doing a good job pacing himself. He went 3 hours on Wednesday, rather on Tuesday, and then he's doing 1 hour tonight. He's pacing himself. Well, bad boy, you are absolutely right. There's an old story about the old bull, young bull, but we won't get into that. But it's all about pacing, and that's what I've done, and here I am. Here's some of the stories of the day. The U.S. military isn't ready for a catastrophic attack here on the country. The National Guard forces just don't have the equipment or the training they need for the job. That's unfortunate. A commission charged by Congress made this report. Even fewer Army National Guard units, they say, are combat ready today than they were nearly a year ago when the Commission on the National Guard and Reserves determined that 88% of the units were not prepared for the fight. The independent commission is charged by Congress to recommend changes in law and policy concerning the Guard and Reserves. I think one of the reasons why, of course, is the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq as they thin our military. A futuristic weapon getting a trial run by the Navy demonstrated its destructive powers at the Naval Surface Warfare Center in Virginia. In that demonstration, the engineers fired the electromagnetic railgun at what they said was a record power level of 10 megajoules. Railguns used electromagnetic energy to launch projectiles long distances, more than 200 nautical miles. Now, because the railgun uses electricity and not gunpowder to fire projectiles, it eliminates the possibility of explosions on these ships. The Navy hopes the railgun will eventually replace the standard 5-inch guns on its ships. The weapon isn't expected to be deployed, at least until 2020. Prodding Congress, President Bush said that lawmakers are jeopardizing the nation's safety by failing to lock in a government eavesdropping law. The president signed what Congress has given him so far, which is now a 15-day extension of the law that allows government surveillance of suspected terrorists. But he said Congress should urgently pass a permanent law on his terms. The law in question allows eavesdroppings of phone calls and emails involving people here in the United States. And the president said that he and Congress are at odds over the update of the law, mainly over the right to give legal immunity to companies that help the government spy on customers. In a moment, Jerry Corsi will react on this and also the possibilities of war with Iran. Climate change could cause severe crop losses in South Asia and Southern Africa over the next 20 years, according to a study. The findings suggest that Southern Africa could lose more than 30% of its main crop, which is corn, maize. You could start looking in the skies tomorrow for Jupiter and Venus to kind of converge. At least it'll look that way. It's going to be an incredible sight. Okay, in a moment, Jerry Corsi on Coast to Coast AM. Well, here he is, Dr. Jerome Corsi. He received his PhD from Harvard University in political science. We turned to him for a lot of breaking stories here on Coast to Coast. In 1981, by the way, he received a top secret clearance from the Agency for International Development, where he assisted in providing anti-terrorism hostage survival training. His latest book, bestseller, The Late Great USA, The Coming Merger with Mexico and Canada. Also, he's been on the program talking about atomic Iran, which we'll talk about, black gold stranglehold as well. Seems like everything you write about, Jerry, is a coast-to-coast topic, my friend.
Well, George, great pleasure and honor to be back with you. And certainly the things I've been writing about have been continuing to be in the news, and a lot of it has, unfortunately, some of it's come true. I wish some of the things about Iran had not come true, but there it's happening every day.
I'm beginning to think you are a soothsayer, my friend.
Oh, you're very kind, George. Some of the things I write about scare me, and I wish they wouldn't come true.
Well, let's talk a little bit, first of all, and I want to get into Iran tonight. I want to get phone calls with you tonight.
Right.
But let's talk a little bit about the president's push in his battle with Congress over this wiretapping bill and law.
Well,
what's your take?
President Bush seems determined to get this electronic surveillance measure extended. He got a 15-day extension of the law to do electronic surveillance of suspected terrorists. I think the Congress is unlikely to give a permanent law. I think Congress is very resistant to see President Bush do eavesdropping, even though President Bush claims this is just intended to deal with terrorists from overseas who may be contacting other terrorists in the United States. Congress, I think, legitimately is concerned about continued invasions on personal freedoms, where Americans who, you know, have done nothing wrong may get involved in the kind of dragnet searches that the National Intelligence Agency or other intelligence agencies in the government may do when these kinds of powers are granted. I think it's a legitimate concern.
Well, it is a legitimate concern. And, of course, there are a lot of Americans, Jerry, who are very upset with the possibility that they could be spied on, even though they have nothing to do with terrorism, that they don't have anything to do with anything. They just don't like it. Now, the other problem, of course, could be the companies that turn so many people in. What are we going to do about them?
Well, that's exactly right, George. You see, the problem is these searches with the powers of the electronic eavesdropping are so great that either the companies or the databases they're looking at go through hundreds of millions of, you know, people easily. You know, just hundreds of millions of different cases can be looked at in one database. So you have 300 million people in the United States. You could easily have people show up in this database and be examined for whatever reason. And how would you know? How would you be able to track it down? And with the companies that, you know, the president wants to be able to pressure to give over data about communications that people are engaging in and patterns of communication, you would have no idea whether you were being examined or not examined by a national security agency. I think these sweeping kinds of powers, which President, and none of us, of course, want there to be terrorists operating in the United States, but there's got to be a balance here between legitimate privacy concerns and overreaching by the government to do law enforcement on terrorists that ends up investigating ordinary citizens who've done nothing wrong.
Jerry, let's switch over to Iran for just a moment, because a lot of this has to do with that. As you know, we are in this midst of a 2008 presidential battle. I'll get your take on that in a moment. But there were some speculating that we could be at war with Iran before the election, that this could be a severe problem. And as you know, there is an executive order that the president signed that does give him the right to preempt any election. First of all, do you think an attack on Iran is still very possible?
I continue to worry about it, George. I was worried about it just a few weeks ago when this boat incident occurred with the Iranian high-speed boats that were charged with harassing U.S. ships. I mean, it was almost like a Gulf of Tonkin incident.
Well, first of all, do you believe that episode? I mean, how stupid could the Iranians be than to try to provoke us right in the middle of all this?
Well, I just think that the whole thing was, again, like a concocted issue where, you know, if you looked at both sides of the tape and they were both released, the Iranian version and the U.S. version, I think the U.S. is almost acting, the Bush administration, with as many as three carrier groups in the Gulf region have acted almost like they want to provoke something that Iran does, the Gulf of Tonkin incident that can be blown out of proportion and made to be a reason to attack Iran. I looked at the incident. It looked almost kind of silly to me. And then on the other side, you've got to say, well, okay, there's legitimate concerns. You know, we had the coal, which was bombed by one of these boats coming and approaching it when the coal was coming into harbor. And so if you're out there at sea and boats are approaching you, I'm sure the naval commanders are legitimately concerned for the safety of the ships and their crews.
Look, if I were the naval commanders on the ships, I would have blasted those boats out of the water.
Right, exactly.
I wouldn't even have checked. I would have said, something's coming our way. You give them one shot over the bow, and if they keep coming, you annihilate them. We've got the technology, as you know, on these ships to take them out. I wouldn't have asked any other questions.
Well, and also there was the incident, if you recall, about, I'm sure you do, the recently where a group of British sailors were captured by one of these Iranian speedboats, and there was a whole incident of them being hostage and having to negotiate their release. So the Iranians are also, on their side, capable with the Revolutionary Guard of being provocative. But it would be very silly and unfortunate if an incident like that escalated out of control, and it was very fortunate it did not. At the same time, you know, I don't think that there'll be the possibility that George Bush could attack unless there were an incident. I mean, we still have this U.S. intelligence estimate, the National Intelligence Estimate, where 16 of U.S. spy agencies, and it was just released really in, you know, just a few weeks ago now, saying that Tehran had shelved its nuclear weapons program in 2003. Now, even today, the French intelligence minister is objecting to that report and saying that the French have information that Iran has not given up its nuclear program. But I don't think that President Bush, in terms of U.S. domestic policy, could launch an attack on Iran when this national intelligence estimate has said that Iran gave up its nuclear program, unless there were an incident like this boat incident, the speedboats of the Iranians harassing U.S. ships, that escalated out of control and led to some kind of a shooting incident. So I think George Bush is looking for, it's almost like, you know, poking the stick in the face of a bear, wanting the bear to take a swipe at you. And if we are provocative with our military in the Gulf, any incident could lead to a war, and that concerns me. One last point here, you know, Russia has also now just delivered the last shipment of the nuclear energy that Iran needs to start their nuclear facility at Bashar that the Russians have built with them. I still think it will take about a year to get that facility running, but the first delivery of the nuclear energy took place on December 17th last year, and I think 5 shipments now have concluded what's necessary. So Iran continues to pursue this nuclear course and is also continuing to enrich its own uranium, ignoring the wishes of the Security Council that Iran stop. So Iran's continuing to be belligerent in the face of the Security Council wishes, and Russia now is working hand-in-hand with Iran to get this nuclear power plant going.
And Jerry, isn't the game of war interesting? Because here we have the Chinese and the Russians also providing the Iranians with the weaponry to fight us if and when we go in.
Well, that's right. I mean, Russia has provided, they delivered to Iran a Tor M1 surface-to-air missile system, one of the best in the world, which, you know, would be make the cost of any attack, any air attack against Iran, either by Israel or the United States, with that Tor M1 system around the nuclear facilities that Iran has, I'm sure we would take losses. And Iran continues to test. They've now tested a second generation, this Ashkura missile, which even has a longer range. Iran, in a retaliation, if there should be an attack, could certainly hit with conventional missiles our troops in the region, which are both in Iraq and Afghanistan, and could hit Israel. So, you know, it's not like a computer game where we think, well, we'll just go in and take out these nuclear sites in Iran. It'll be all over with in a few hours.
It's not like Syria.
It's not where we can just come in, Israel come in with a few planes and take out one building that Syria has that might be a nuclear establishment. There's well over 100 sites, clearly 100 top sites in Iran that would have to be taken out in an airstrike. Iran's a much bigger and more complex country. It's not sure we would get the regime. I mean, look how long it took us to get Saddam Hussein, and we still haven't found Osama bin Laden. If we did not get Ahmadinejad or the top mullahs running Iran, they would then, after an air attack, have perfect reason to say with Russia and to the world, look, we've been attacked, now we need to pursue nuclear weapons. It's a very complex situation. I think I've said here now for years that a war against Iran would be a mistake and a very severe problem. And I continue to regret that we've not supported the Iranian freedom fighters around the world and within Iran that want to change their own country But we just can't think that we can have a military attack against Iran. It'll all be over in a matter of a few days. That's just not going to be the case.
Here's what concerns me, Jerry. You know the way I get this intuitive feeling.
Yes, I do.
Number one, the economy in this country is going down the tubes. I don't care how much the Fed reduces interest rates. They would have to reduce it down to zero in order to stimulate this economy. They haven't done that yet. That's one problem. The other problem is we're coming up to this election, and things have been relatively too darn quiet as far as I'm concerned. And then, of course, I think the third problem and the biggest that faces all of us is that anything could happen in the Middle East that could get this tinderbox on fire. And, you know, I'm afraid that we're in the middle of this possibility right now where that could happen, and it could happen relatively soon.
Well, it concerns me when you get your instincts and your intuition, George, that something could happen, because we are truly, you know, one suicide bomber or one nutcase away from the Middle East blowing up into a major regional war. I mean, you've got the Gaza Strip, which is, you know, the people in the Gaza are now breaking into Egypt in order to get food. The Gaza is, like, out of control with Hamas still dedicated to the destruction of Israel.
And you know, most Americans, Jerry, I don't want to interrupt you. You tell me if I'm correct. I think most Americans have forgotten we're even in Iraq right now. It's almost as if it's a non-issue. We've got Americans over there. They're still getting killed. Iraqis are still getting killed. And though the surge appears to be working, we've still got 100,000-plus troops over there. I have this feeling that Americans have simply forgotten about the war. So, you know, a new type of action would almost make people think, uh-oh, now we're starting something new. I think they think the war in Iraq is almost over.
Well, I think you're right, George. And also Afghanistan, where we have troops in Afghanistan that are also getting killed. And Afghanistan is a dangerous situation with Pakistan. So this northwestern region of Pakistan is still a wild tribal region supporting the Taliban. And it's not clear that Musharraf is going to be able to hold elections in Pakistan. Pakistan is still, you know, recovering from the assassination of Bhutto, which I continue to believe was an action that Musharraf and the government engineered. And with Pakistan having nuclear weapons, it's not clear that the nuclear weapons in Pakistan could not fall into the hands of a radical regime if Musharraf should lose control. So the entire region, there's any number of scenarios. Hezbollah in Lebanon is rearmed with their missiles now to the north of Israel. They could be an attack force against Israel in any day. And with the election approaching, and again, I don't think that there's in either party yet a settling in, that the top candidates are really listening to the core base of the party. I'm sure among the Republican Party, McCain is not wooing over the conservatives who have viewed McCain for years as being closer to the Democrats. I mean, he supported Ted Kennedy in this immigration, comprehensive immigration reform. Many conservatives are still angry about the McCain-Feingold campaign reform legislation. And I watched the debate tonight with both Obama and Hillary Clinton. And, of course, it looked like a love-in. I mean, they were both acting like family. I'm not sure how long that's going to last. And as Obama gains, which he is in the Democratic Party, I don't see Bill and Hillary just going through a nice campaign. When Obama was surging in South Carolina, Bill Clinton certainly got nasty, and that was by design. So I think both parties are a long way yet from having settled into a candidate that the base of the parties are satisfied with.
I have my latest figures show, as of today, that 3,943 Americans have died in Iraq, 3,231 of them in combat, but nearly 4,000 have died in Iraq, 482 U.S. military deaths in Afghanistan. But, Jerry, guess how many Americans, soldiers, have been wounded in Iraq since the conflict began in 2003?
It's got to be at least 10 times that number or more.
It is 30,000.
Right.
30,000 Americans have been wounded. So even though we talk about the horde of the fatalities, you've got 30,000 Americans, some of whom have been maimed.
Well, it's a lot easier to watch, you know, American Idol and to realize the tragedy, because many of these soldiers have been, you know, seriously wounded, losing arms, legs, their lives destroyed. And we've not done enough for the American military returning with injuries from war. And I think you're right, George. The country has a very short memory even while we're at war. I think and the economic situation is also going to get worse. I agree with you there, too.
Well, you know how the media used to be embedded with all the troops. I mean, nobody's even there anymore, are they? Or if they are, they're not reporting much.
Top of the news anymore. You're exactly right, George, and it's amazing.
We'll be back in a moment. We'll take phone calls with Jerry Corsi. Well, next hour, intuitive remote viewer Sean David Morton joins us. But we'll be back with Jerry Corsi in a moment at Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back, Jerry Corsi, our guest this hour. Jerry, what's going on with Dick Cheney? Where is he?
He seems like he's in deep storage, doesn't he? Dick Cheney is still working very hard on the Iranian case. I mean, that file has been in his office now. And he's also working, I think, more actively even in some ways than Condi Rice on the Middle East, trying to engineer a Palestinian state solution to the Israeli, you know, continuing crisis, dealing with Hamas in the Gaza Strip and Hezbollah in Lebanon. So Cheney's very active, even though he's not very visible these days. He actually concerns me a little bit more when he can't see what he's doing. But I'm quite confident that with Stephen Hadley, his national security advisor, they're working very hard on both Iran and Israel.
Let's go to the calls. We'll pick it up, first of all, by going to our East of the Rockies line. It's first-time caller line. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, George. Mr. Corsi. George,
yes, sir.
I love your show.
Thank you.
Been addicted to it ever since I found you. My comment, I want to make a couple comments and points real quick. A lot of people talk about how we lost 4,000 troops with 30,000 injured in the war. But I'd just like to point out that we took out one of the largest military forces in the world at the time that was fully equipped by Russia and some by us. We lost 4,000 and we got the whole country. A lot of people tend to forget that during the D-Day landing alone, during World War II, we lost 150,000 on the beach landing alone. And we've taken over a whole country losing 4 grand. I think we've done a pretty good job. And I'd also like to say that there was a guy I listened to a while back on your show that was commenting on one of the Russian commanders was awed about how well we executed the war against Iraq the first time, and how he was saying that he was surprised how farly advanced our military had come.
Mm-hmm.
So I just wanted to make those comments, and I'll take whatever you say off the air.
Okay, very good. Thanks for the call. Go ahead, Jerry. I'll let you react to that.
Well, I think we've got to acknowledge, and I want to be the one of the first to do it, that our military have performed admirably every time we've asked them to accomplish any mission. We've got the best men and women in the world defending the United States of America, and they do it with honor and distinction. And I'd like to salute all the men and women and former military listening to the show tonight for the great courage with which they've defended and put their lives on the line for the United States of America.
And whether they agree with what they're doing or not, they're the best in the world.
That's a different issue. I mean, politically, we can argue whether we need to continue to be in Iraq, whether we need to get out of Afghanistan. I think there's good arguments that say that we've accomplished the mission now, as much as we're going to accomplish. And I think we're going to move towards a pullout. At least I hope we're beginning to seriously consider those issues politically, both Democrats and Republicans. But regardless of the politics, we've got to salute the military and acknowledge what an outstanding job the military continues to do defending the United States of America.
You know, Jerry, it's a catch-22, because the strength of our military and the strength of the United States is that the military does what it's ordered to do. What happens if we get to a point that we end up, let's say, one day, God forbid, with some leader, some elected official, who begins to make crazy off-the-wall judgments, sending our military into places we shouldn't go, harming Americans, jeopardizing this country? Does the military have the right, in your opinion, to simply say, we're not going, you're nuts, you're wrong, we're not doing this? Or do they simply say, yes, sir, you're the commander-in-chief, we're on our way?
It's a very difficult situation, George, and certainly after the Nuremberg trials, the military would have the justification to object to orders given to the military by the commander-in-chief. Whether practically that could ever happen is another question. But your comments prompt me to reach out and comment that Ron Paul did in this campaign seriously raise issues, saying that we need to be concerned about how much we use our military power. I mean, in my own politics, I go back to George Washington in his farewell address, reminding us to avoid foreign entanglements and to be engaged in those military actions only where the national security interests of the United States are critical and directly involved. We cannot be the policemen of the world, and George Bush, who campaigned on no nation building, is now, for the longest we've almost ever stayed in a war, in Iraq, trying to nation build. And again, we see how difficult it is to do, and I'm not sure that it's the job of the U.S. military or what we should be doing constitutionally, especially in a war that was not declared by Congress. So I'm very cautious about wanting to use the military power. The men and women of our military are tremendous in what their capacities are, but I think our military leaders have got to be very, very restrained in our desire to use the military, except in the most exceptional cases where we absolutely have to.
Let's go to our East of the Rockies line. Welcome to the program. Hi there. Hello. Go ahead, please.
Hello?
Nope.
Hello?
He's not hearing me, so we're going to have to move on. Too bad. He was on hold for a long time. Wildcard line, welcome to the program. Hi there.
Hi, George. My name is Chris, and I'm calling from Minnesota. First of all, I respect Colonel Corsi's service, although I highly disagree with him about a couple of points that I would like to make.
First of all, just let me say, I'm not ex-military. I was disqualified medically during the Vietnam War. I have eczema. I had it all my life, a hereditary situation, so I did not serve in the military.
Okay.
I never like that to be said because I don't want to have anyone ever assert that I said that I was in the military when I was not.
All right. Honest. Thank you, Jerry.
Appreciate it. Anyway, my points are as follows. First of all, with respect to Congress not declaring war, Congress did authorize force in Iraq. I think we're playing semantics when we say that they authorized force but didn't declare war. But second of all, I am very upset with his comments regarding the claims that the U.S. is trying to create another Gulf of Tonkin incident or is antagonizing Iran. If you look at the current state of the Iranian government, we see statements all the time by a regime that's threatening the destruction of the U.S. But not only are they threatening our destruction, they're actually seeking uranium, and they're actually working with North Korea to build nuclear weapons. And the idea that here we are, being mean to somebody else is, I just think, dangerously naive, especially given Iran's history of kidnapping Americans, threatening its neighbors, sponsoring terrorism through Hezbollah and the like. And prior to 9/11, the terrorist that killed the most Americans was Hezbollah, sponsored by Iran.
Yeah, but they were all Saudis, most of them.
Hezbollah was not Saudis. Hezbollah was sponsored by Iran, and they killed, prior to 9/11, Hezbollah killed more Americans than any other terrorist group.
Would you agree with that, Jerry?
Well, I want to comment, George, that, having written Atomic Iran,
stay with us too, Colin,
and also Showdown with Nuclear Iran, I've written two books saying how dangerous Iran is. This regime is one of the most dangerous regimes on the face of the earth. That's clear. Support of Hezbollah, their support of Hamas. But what I'm concerned about is I don't want to see us get into another preemptive war with a country like Iran unless, Iran were absolutely threatening us directly, and which they are not at this point with, the nuclear program. I've said there are other solutions. People think we either have to appease Iran Well, we'd have to go to war with Iran. There are a whole range of solutions. We got South Africa to stop apartheid without a war. Even the Soviet Union, we got to break apart without firing a shot. There's a whole range of solutions where we could declare regime change and work with the expatriate Iranians around the world that want freedom in their own country as well as within Iran and assist the positive forces of freedom within the country for change. The problem we have with Iran is the radical regime, not the Iranian people. The Iranian people are great friends of the United States and have also for centuries had Jews living in their midst. Go back to the Bible, you know, the Iranians, the Persians, gave the wherewithal to the Jews to return from Babylonian captivity and to build the Second Temple.
Jerry, this world after Israel was formed in 1948 failed and forgot the Palestinians. They should have equally have done something for them as well. Instead, those people are living in squalor. They have no hope. And when you have no hope, you begin to do very despicable things. And I'm telling you, that's the root cause of where all this is. And unless that gets fixed and gets fixed immediately without all this rhetoric that is going back and forth, that's been doing it for years. I mean, I even remember during the Carter administration, everybody thought, oh, well, finally, peace in the Middle East. We have got to get this situation resolved right now. And then we've got to at least start dealing with the minds of why these people then hate us so much. You don't
hey,
see them. You don't see them attacking all these other countries.
Well, and George,
it's us, but
I completely agree with you. You've got George Bush.
Chris is still with us too.
Well, George Bush was the first to say that we need a Palestinian state to openly declare it. And I agree that the Middle East, dealing with right and wrong in the Middle East is never going to solve anything. And the second point, I think Rubin, when at the end of his life he came to the conclusion that war was the problem in the Middle East, never the solution, that every shot fired in anger created revenge that set another generation of hate, that's not going to solve the problems in the Middle East. We've
hey,
got
George,
to look at these solutions.
Yeah, go ahead, Chris.
Can I just quickly comment?
Sure.
With respect to the Palestinians, you know, I think that, first of all, I think it's very unfortunate that what the Palestinian people have gone through, but it's not just been since the creation of Israel. You know, they were herded from one Arab country to the next, including the, I think it was called Black September in the 1970s when thousands of them were exterminated by Jordan when they were expelled from that country. So I think the Arab countries use that as an excuse to foment hate toward the West. But the bottom line for me is that we have regimes like Iran that want to take us back to the Stone Age, that don't believe that they believe in this radical Islam, that you're either with them or you're an infidel. And until we can conquer that, I think we're in for a lot of trouble ahead.
See, but here's the biggest problem, Chris. And I wonder if you agree with me. If we had gone into Afghanistan, did the thorough job and gotten Osama bin Laden, and then finished the job there, Saddam Hussein would have been contained. And then if Iran had started its rhetoric like it is now, I think every American would have said, this is justified. We better go shut those people up right now. Instead, we've got massive distrust, whether it's right or wrong, since Iraq. You agree with that?
Well, I partially agree with that, except that I would say this. We have Iran racing to get a nuclear weapon. Had we stayed the course that you proposed and kept Saddam in place, first of all, I don't know that we could have contained him, but we would have had, I strongly believe we would have had two countries against the U.S. racing for a nuclear weapon instead of just Iran.
I don't think Saddam could have done much of anything, honestly. This guy was watched so closely. And you know what? He was buying people off with his oil for food dollars. You
know? Well, that's where the problem is. I don't know that he was watched closely. In fact, he kicked the UN weapons inspectors out for several years before they were brought in, reluctantly so, prior to the U.S. war against Iraq. And he was cheating. He was selling food. He was selling oil to France and Germany and Russia and other countries
in exchange for millions of dollars that he could have, you know, put on the open market, bought technology.
Well, that's because he was greedy, and he was probably taking most of the money.
But what was he doing? What would he have done with it if we would have stayed the course in Afghanistan, left the rest of this alone? I strongly think we would have had two countries racing for a nuclear weapon.
All right, but don't forget who propped him up the first time.
You're right about that.
Okay, thanks, Chris. Appreciate your call. Let's move on to another one. Let's go to our wild card line. You're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Hi, it's Clark from Rochester.
Hello there. That's an interesting name. Go ahead.
Okay, what I want to bring up, though, is a direct comparative analysis as to what's really going on as opposed to what we've been told. You know, we have the Islamic states racing to get nuclear weapons, but comparatively speaking, why does Israel have stockpiled well over 500 nuclear warheads? Okay, who's got the firepower in that area? They have a Jericho 3 missile that has a range of over 1,500 miles. If they wanted to, they could incinerate anyone within that radius at any time. The real reason that we've been over there is basically to fighting the war for the Zionists on their expansion of Greater Israel. If you look at the memoirs of Theodor Herzl, who was the father of modern Zionism, we find in Volume 7 of his works that he called for the expansion of Israel to an area that covers from the Mediterranean as far east as the Euphrates that goes through the middle of Baghdad, as far north as southern Turkey, as far south as Saudi Arabia, as far east as the Nile. Now, why would those people be entitled to that checkerboard of the earth?
Well, you're right. He did do that, but there aren't a lot of people who subscribe and believe in that theory. Jerry?
Well, George, the reality of Israel, if you think about it, is Israel is not trying to expand territory. And the long-term issue for Israel is going to be, one, basically a demographics. I mean, already today in Israel, I'm not sure the Jews long-term are going to be the majority in Israel. You know, you've got a consideration that part of the issue of giving up some of the West Bank and Gaza is simply to get control of an area increasingly smaller, where the Jewish state is ruled by a Jewish majority. You project this out another 20 or 30 years, I think the realistic forces in Israel understand that long-term accommodation and peace with their, you know, their Islamic neighbors, including the Palestinians, is a political necessity. That's why I think that the Olmert government has fought as hard as it has to try to find a solution short of war. And I think it's why the Israeli government is so reluctant to take on Iran unless it came to an absolute last moment where Israel was certain that Iran was going to produce nuclear weapons, and they're not there yet. And I continue to say there's a lot of solutions in the Middle East short of war that we've got to consider. And I think the Bush administration, the Clinton administration before, I think was pursuing, and the next administration, whether it's Democratic or Republican, I think is going to have to continue exploring diplomatic solutions rather than, you know, ramping up to a war. A war will just accelerate the problems in the Middle East, not solve any fundamental issues.
I'm afraid that if the war in Iran takes place, the only way to quickly get it started and ended is tactical nukes. Now, I'm not advocating that, but I'm saying that's what's going to have to happen.
All the scenarios for a war with Iran ramp up very quickly to tactical nuclear weapons and a regional war.
You have to. If you're going to attack, you have to punish them, Jerry, or they're going to retaliate.
And Russia's not going to sit by and watch a client state taken over or destroyed easily. I mean, I think a war would expand very quickly into a regional war that would easily become nuclear.
Jerry, stay with us on that throughout the months ahead, my friend. Thank you for being on the show.
Always a great pleasure and honor. Thank you, George.
It's Jerry Corsi, and you can see some of Jerry's writings at worldnetdaily.com. I'm George Norrie, back with intuitive remote viewer Sean David Morton on Coast to Coast AM.